Well, it's been a while since my last recording. I had to take the trip from New York to St. John and then return home. I decided before I could start it that I also needed to visit the grave of my great grandmother at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. I don't think anybody's been there in at least 100 years. She died in 1906. That was an interesting year. That's the year of the San Francisco earthquake. But in general, it was a bad year for my family. She passed away in Los Angeles with three young children. The youngest was 3 years old, and the oldest was probably five or six. Also, across the border in Mexico, my grandfather had married, and his wife delivered a baby girl, Dolores. Isabel, his first wife, died about 2 weeks later, and the following year, in July, Dolores died too. So it does not sound like 1906 was a great year. Her grave is in the corner of the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. She is one of the older tombstones there. I think the oldest I saw was 1904. The cemetery allegedly opened in 1899, which would have been the year she arrived in Long Beach. So after that, I decided to come back and finish the rest of this story. So I guess we should start with why they were in Rye and how they got there. Back around 1634, one of my grandfathers, Nicholas, came to America by ship from Hertfordshire, which is a county north of London, where they had lived for quite some time. The oldest records we have was the birth of his grandfather in 1524, and a deed from about 1580, giving the land to his father and other parts of the estate went to different members of the family. The estate was quite small. It was some leased farmland and a cottage. I don't know why he decided to come to America. I have no idea. There are no real records. There are some records of his marriage, and that's about it. He arrived in the Boston area in 1634. He then, according to land records, owned a piece of land in Waterford, Massachusetts. Shortly thereafter, he sold parts of it and eventually all of it, and then he moved to Connecticut to Stamford, where he was one of the founding families of that city. Subsequently, the family moved to Rye, New York, which is not far away, allegedly purchasing land from Indians. They had a property of about 120 acres, according to the land records. Eventually, that property was forfeited after the Revolutionary War, went to another family who then eventually sold it to a group called the Osborne, which created a sanitarium or nursing home there in the late 1800s. So, what brought them to New York City? Well, during that time, that was right after the Revolutionary War, and they were evacuated on a ship called the Mercury that left September 25th, 1783, for St. John's, New Brunswick. the date that the ship I left on was September 25th, too, and it took probably essentially the same course to get there, only obviously much faster. I think we did it in 2 or 3 days with multiple stops for many hours at a time. But for them, it took quite a number of days. I have, and we'll talk about it a little later, a diary from Sarah Frost, and she leaves around June 14th and doesn't arrive until the 29th or 28th of June. So by sea, it was a very long voyage. Part of the reason that they left was that they were Tories, or what the Canadians call loyalists. They were property owners, and the land that they were on in Rye was right between the revolutionary forces under Washington at White Plains and the English-controlled forces in New York City. The Harlem River was probably the boundary for that, and between those two places, it was pretty much no man's land. So the revolutionaries pillaged and patrolled that area, as well as the English troops. And neither of them had much sympathy for the inhabitants of that area. So it was not uncommon for them at night to put all their livestock in the house with them, because they were afraid that people would take it or steal it during the evening. And apparently they would not get compensated for this if it happened. Consequently, I'm going to read you a little idea about what the loyalists would have thought. This is from Walter Bates's book about the Spring Fleet of 1783. And he quotes somebody named Delancey, that loyalist inhabitants of America were truly loyal. Those who acted from principle were unhesitating supporters of the British government in its unjustifiable and tyrannic invasions of rights and liberties of the American people. United States writers have naturally, perhaps, so described them, while few English historians who have treated American history have either taken a similar view or have ignored them altogether. The history, of course, of the Loyalists at the American Revolutionary epoch and of their plans for relief from British tyranny which then oppressed America, has never been written. There can be no greater error than to suppose that the Loyalists as a whole were willing to submit quietly to extractions of the mother country and her invasion of their rights and liberties as British subjects. As Americans, they felt those grievances and were as indignant as at the treatment that they were subjected to as those of their countrymen who took up arms. But they wished to fight the battle for those rights and liberties and the redress of those grievances with the powerful weapons which the Constitution of England gave them, as to other Englishmen, weapons which have proved successful before, as they have proved successful since in similar emergencies: freedom of speech, freedom of pen, freedom of the press. They desire by political agitation to force the home government to change of policy, or to drive it from power and place in office the foes of the opposition of the colonies. Their enemy was the ministry of Lord North, not the King of England, to whom they owed and had sworn allegiance. They object, and they were prevented from carrying out, royal folly in England and demagogic fanaticism in America equally joined hands to crush a constitutional settlement of the dispute, which brought about a bloody civil war and finally effected a termination of the quarrel, unlooked for by either party at the commencement, period. So basically, they didn't want to go to war. They wanted to use political means to solve the problems of taxation without representation. which is actually fairly interesting. Anyway, somehow the family arrived in New York in the early fall of 1783, and they were put aboard a ship called the Mercury, which was commandeered or hired by Captain Dickerson. And in their particular case, they were placed aboard for reasons of charity, quote unquote. There's no record of when the Mercury arrived in St. John, but I assume it was approximately a month later, towards the end of October. It could have been sooner or later, depending on the winds and the weather. That part I don't know. One of the reasons that the Loyalists also left was, I think, probably a religious reason. According to Bates, quote unquote, New Haven was settled with the most violent Puritans who claimed so much liberty to themselves that they left none for others. They hated the idea of king, lord, and commons. They sent agents to fight against the King of England. They denied jurisdiction of the Bishop of London. Religion and government, properly speaking, they have none nor had, but in impertinence, they excel all the world except Boston and Spain. If I could repeat all of the religious societies and volunteer associations which have arisen through their strife and self-will, it would display a prolific invention of mankind. I shall mention a few of the most considerable: Saybrook, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, Methodists, Baptists, Scandinavians, Lutherans, Brownists, Independents, Quakers, Old Lights, New Lights, Rogerism, Davisism, Unitarians, Universalists, Separatists, Hominites, Bookites, and Peterites. This is quite a list. And he talks also about the tortures, etc., that the Puritans placed upon other denominations in the area. Let's see. The proceedings of the ecclesiastical courts during the early history of Connecticut were often marked with much severity. In the course of 160 years, they bored the tongues with hot needles, cut off ears, branded on the forehead, banished, imprisoned, and hanged more Quakers, Adamites, ranters, Episcopalians for what they call heresy, blasphemy, and witchcraft than there are instances of persecution in Fox's Book of Martyrdom. And this is according to Walter Bates. So part of being a Loyalist also had to do, it sounds like, with religious issues. They also were afraid after the British withdrew that they would be arrested or tortured or killed. So consequently, large numbers of people left the United States for either England, Canada, or the Caribbean. So let's now move to the voyage. Sarah Frost was a mother with small children. She took the journey in the spring of 1783 and talks about being on board a ship with her husband and her children. The interesting thing about her story is it sounds like most of the trip was spent either waiting to leave or on shore or in the fog. Her diary starts on May 25th. On the 30th of May, she goes ashore to visit friends. On the 11th, they start. By the 14th, they are anchored off of Staten Island. And around the 15th, they start out and pass Sandy Head. At that time, they had about 13 ships. On the 19th, they're 250 miles from Sandy Hook. On the 20th, they're 500 miles. And then the 21st, they run into fog and are, quote unquote, becalmed. That lasts for most of the rest of the voyage. On the 25th, she mentions more fog, and now a measles outbreak is on board, affecting all the young children. On the 26th of June, they sight land, and on the 28th, they arrive. When she finally goes on shore on the 29th, she describes it as, quote unquote, the roughest land I have ever seen. And that same day, they're put on land with no shelters and must start anew. They're eventually going to travel another 60 miles up the St. John River to a place they were promised. Now, I don't know what happened to the kid family. They traveled later in the year. it appears that they settled near St. John, but I'm not sure. We have a census record from the late 1800s that shows where the property they owned was, or the place that they were living at the time of the census was. But I'm not sure if this was the original property they got or owned. There is a record in the Canadian archives suggesting that the same man, Captain Dickerson, who arranged for the travel, petitioned the king in the early 1780s, maybe 84, 85, for land for himself and the Kidd family, along with a number of other families. So eventually they were given property to farm and to live on. But other than that, very little is known. It's strange then that they should live in Canada for so many years, and then my great-grandfather deciding to come to America, not America's in the Northeast where they're from, but all the way to the southwest corner of the continent, to Southern California. But that part we don't know. There are no records of him. I do have a picture of him, and somewhere I've seen a picture of him with Jenny, but that's it. Anyway, I've hoped you enjoyed this traveling adventure, part history, part real life. I found St. John's nice and quaint. The Loyalist House was an interesting place to visit. Like all Canadian cities, it's very artsy. They have much more money to put into things like that than we do. But it was rather cold. It reminds me somewhat of San Francisco, a lot of steep hills, but all crammed into a very small area. Anyway, thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you later.